Mamma Mia. Here we go again.
He's at it again. Pierce Brosnan here in the studio with us, insisting on singing in another Mamma Mia film.
Yes, it's Pierce Brosnan joining you. Oh, what a movie. I'm so excited to talk about Mamma Mia. This is not Pierce Brosnan. This is Glenn Falkenstein from Falcon Screen with Film Fight Club. And we are joined by freelance writer and critic Virat Nehru.
Hello. Also not Pierce Brosnan.
Although he used to have Bond in his Twitter handle, right? email?
Can we not talk about that again, please? ever. Thank you, Chris.
That is true. And we have Debbie Zhao from the Social Film Network, freelance writer and critic, and also a contributor to the MIFF, Melbourne International Film Festival.
And filmmaker. She's incredibly talented in all dimensions.
And at the Critics' Cabin this year. Debbie, great. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me again.
And we also have, lastly, Sydney filmmaker and all-around gadabout, Chris Evans.
Last and definitely least.
Chris. And we have also joining us Benson Wu, the director of the inaugural Taiwan Film Festival, which kicks off on July 27 in Sydney and runs through to July 29. Benson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So, how do you feel about the Taiwanese Film Festival being launched for the first time ever?
I think it's really exciting. It's been really amazing to have all the community and all the art organization here in Sydney that actually really supported with everything I'm doing at the moment. So it's really, really like couldn't do it without everyone's support and the help. So yeah, it's really exciting. Yeah.
Cool. So what led about to the creation of this film festival?
The creation, I think it started about 8 months ago after I finished my work with Sydney Film Festival. And I was just like, oh, there's so many great Taiwanese films I never get to show in Sydney or in Australia. So I was like, oh, rather than wait for next year to hopefully other film to wait, kind of wait for other film festivals to pick Taiwanese film, I was like, oh well, I might as well start it myself. So that's kind of my kind of motivation to start the whole thing by myself. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So that's really, really interesting. So how's the community responded to it? So have people really loved your creation?
I think it was it's really good. I got really positive feedback from a lot of people, especially like I got massive feedback from Melbourne or people from Brisbane. Was like, oh, are you actually coming to other area under Sydney? So I think there is like the Taiwanese community or even like say Asian community that kind of desperate for more Asian films to be shown on the big screen or even in just like in the film festival way of presentation. Yeah.
And how have you gone about choosing the films that have been selected for the festival this time around?
Yeah, it was hard because it was my first year and then it was tough. I think because I have the kind of like guidance from the film festival and also some people from Taipei Film Festival. So they kind of, at first I think about a month ago, they suggested to give me a dean for the programming.
Right.
Yeah, it's really interesting talking about one of the films that piqued my fancy was The Bold, The Corrupt, and The Beautiful, which sounds like a very interesting title. And it won the 2017 Taipei Golden Horse Film Festival for Best Feature and Leading Actress. So that's really interesting. And what did you... It looks like a really cool film.
Yeah. It's definitely one of the best films from Taiwan in 2017. Even though I think there's some people, certain group, if you read up the review on Google, I think some people will kind of give you a bad review about this film. But I think it is quite unusual to see a film that's really all about female representation and how female empowerment. The film is really, really nice done, and then you can kind of see a lot of the political culture and that, the whole history of Taiwan that back in the 1970 or 60, like how it was influenced by the Japanese and like different diverse culture. So I think it's a very interesting film, and so I was like, yeah, I gotta put it in the program this year.
No, that sounds really fascinating.
Excellent.
I'm curious as well, because obviously some very notable directors have come out of Taiwan. So, you know, like, especially now in the 2000s and now in the 2010s, like, have you noticed a change or shift in the style of Taiwanese cinema or the trends that it's going into?
Yeah. For me personally, I found the more directors actually coming out in the last 10 years are actually been more supported by their own style and their own vision. Like I say, for Hou Hsiao-hsien, the director, he has been kind of ex-producer for many, many films the last 3 years rather than making his own film. And then he's always been kind of guidance for those new directors, say, okay, you should just follow your vision or your style, your creativity, rather than kind of sell yourself for the mainstream cinematography or, market. So yeah, I think you can see a lot of films that have been quite arty and more kind of speak up their own generation's voice or their view rather than like making it as a selling point of a film. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the films I saw that Hou Hsiao-hsien has produced is Father to Son, which I thought sounds very interesting.
One of my favorite films.
Right. From the description, it sounds like something that I could see in Hou Hsiao-hsien's style, but is it actually quite a bit different?
Yeah. Well, I think the director, Yao Chun-shou, he's been working with Hou Hsiao-hsien for, like, I think, a lot since when he was still a short film filmmaker, and then to feature film now. I think this is the third film in feature film working with Hou Hsiao-hsien. So I think his style has a lot of influence by him, but I think at the same time he's trying to get away with it a little bit, but I think he's not doing it too well on that.
Right.
Yeah.
I saw at Sydney Film Festival one of the other films in the competition, selection you're showing, The Great Buddha. Which reminds me a lot of what you're saying, because that was one of the most stylistically distinctive films I've seen this year. You know, very unusual and very definitely inventive. Can you tell people a bit about that film who might be listening in?
Yeah, The Great Buddha Plus is seriously so good. It's been playing a lot of film festivals. I think it's also playing in August. It's Melbourne Film Festival. Melbourne International Film Festival. And then it's a film that really, really honestly showed the classes and level of the society that's in Taiwan. So you get to see how the wealthy are living, and then how the kind of like lower class are dealing with them, and how those people doesn't really see themselves as a lower class, but they're just kind of living happily in a way, but in a way not really. It's a really honest film that kind of speak up for the kind of low cost. I don't know if I can say that, but yeah, I think that's what the director's trying to show.
Yeah, I really liked it's like the lower classes as, you know, watching the ordinary lives of the higher classes as TV. I thought that was really clever and funny social commentary.
Yeah. It's a great film.
Moving away from feature films for a moment, I noticed you have a short film prize in the short film competition, which you're seeing festivals do more and more. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think it's a funny way for, like, the film industry in Taiwan. Is short film actually is a big thing in the Taiwan, like, the whole media industry. I found there's so many short film festivals in Taiwan that always, in a way, actually got more attention in Taiwan locally than the whole international film festival stuff. And so when I start programming the short film, I look into all of the work. I was like, they're really, really amazing. Like, even for The Great Buddha Plus, it was started as a short film as well, and then it got made into a feature film. So I was like, yeah, I really want to support those young filmmakers and then have a chance to let their film to be seen to the international audience. So, yeah.
Looking at the documentaries in the program, one that really caught my interest is The Black Bear Forest, which sounds fascinating when you look at it, when it's about an indigenous hunter and a female ecologist going into a national park looking for evidence for black bears. I mean, that sounds something like, it's nothing that I've ever thought of or imagined to be in a documentary.
Yeah. I love this documentary so much. I've been telling people this is like the Taiwanese version of the planet Earth. It's so well done. Like, it really, really captured the wildlife and then the mountain range of Taiwan and then the scenery, everything. But then it's so nicely done with how documenting those two researchers trying to find the black bear and their journey, how one is really academic scientist trying to use like an academic way to find the black bear trace, but the other one is like aboriginal Taiwanese and using his own way to find the black bear. So you get to see how they interact with each other and then slowly they kind of build this really, really close relationship together. So the documentary, the narrative kind of shifted from really, really wildlife documentary into how turning into like focusing those two characters' relationship. I love it. It's really one of the best documentaries I've ever seen.
It's interesting because it seems like it's an excuse to bring two cultures together that otherwise would not come together, you know, from a traditional way of living and a modern way of life.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's amazing.
Wonderful. So the festival kicks off in a few days. For those who want to go and see the films, where do we go? How do we get tickets? When can we see it?
So you can still, sadly, a lot of films have sold out already.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
The Ascension and the opening film sold out, and like the one we mentioned earlier, The Boulder Crop, The Beautiful, sold out. And then the other one is The Story of the Stone, the gay film, which has sold out as well. But if you're still interested in seeing, say, like Black Bear Forest, The Great Buddha Plaza, Father Son, you can still go onto our websites, www.taiwanfilmfestival.org.au, and you can still buy a ticket there, or you can come to Event Cinema George Street and come to the box office. You can buy it on the day as well if it's not sold out.
So, considering so many movies are sold out, maybe you can tell us who our listeners need to murder to get the tickets from.
Or which ones you'd recommend.
slightly more PG, perhaps, you know, calm, I guess.
Wait, what you'd recommend people catch of what's available.
The one that hasn't sold out, I think I would really recommend the documentary Black Bear Forest. It's one of the documentaries or one of the film you will never regret. You come and watch the film, you'll be like, I'm so glad I can. And then, but also another one is called The Last Painting, which has the Taiwan transgender called Kiwi Baby featured in this film. And the film actually talks about the political issue, the sexual identity, the living lifestyle in Taiwan. It's a very, very heavy film. So people who like thriller or kind of serious film, this is definitely the film. And it's so arty as well.
Cool. Well, we're definitely looking forward to it. Benson, best of luck for the opening tonight. And
thank you so much.
And thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, good luck with the festival.
Good luck.
And we'll be right back. Speaking all things Mamma Mia, here we go again. Trooper, lights are going to find me. And that was, I think, fairly my favorite ABBA song, Super Trooper. We are back on Film Fight Club. It's so, so good. So we'll be talking Mamma Mia in a moment. We'll also be talking The Equalizer 2, which is in cinemas now, and the James Gunn controversy. The Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2 director was recently fired by Disney from Guardians of the Galaxy 3 following the resurfacing of old tweets. We'll be talking about that later in the program and also in our podcast, which you can download everywhere, and we'll just continue to show on to that. And before we get into Mamma Mia, here we go again, we want to talk film festivals. And we have our MIFS critic campus person who has just returned from another film festival very, very far north.
Yeah, so hello, I'm Debbie, and I was recently at the Vision Splendid Outback Film Festival, which is held in Winton, Queensland, every year. Winton's about a 22-hour bus ride from Brisbane. Don't let that put you off. You can fly. It is expensive, but you can fly. We just took the bus route. So it ran for about 1 week up in Winton, and it's great for their tourism as well. And a lot of, you know, nomads and local townspeople and from neighbouring towns like Longreach and Townsville come down to visit the festival. It's created by Greg Dogolopolov. So it's like full of Australian films. Some of the films that were there this year was the opening night film In Like Flynn, which was absolutely terrible. But Sweet Country, The Butterfly Tree, Strange Colours was there this year.
Strange Colours. I've heard so many good things about Strange Colours from everyone who's seen it, and I haven't, so I'm jealous.
It was one of the victims of the terrible clash programming of Sydney Film Fest this year.
But we love you, Sydney Film Fest.
We do, just program better.
The programming,
Shout out to 2019, was it June 5th? They've already got the scheduling down.
See how MIF does it, and maybe you know, copy that.
And we will be coming to you at MIFF in the coming weeks, where we have many critics talking about many, many wonderful films. But
it's
back to
Melbourne International Film Festival, for those who don't live, eat and breathe films
every day.
Every day.
Yeah, so I was there and as a student. So we from UNSW, so we collaborated with Griffith Film School, the Hong Kong Academy of Arts, and a Japanese uni as well. And we made films in teams, and we showed them as part of the Qantas Short Film Festival, a short film competition. At the very end of the festival.
Awesome.
Wait, does it mean you made a film too?
Yes, I did make a film.
Oh my God, fantastic!
Yeah, so I produced a film as part of the festival.
Wonderful.
I guess technically.
That's like such a low-key, you know, brag. That's the lowest-key brag I've seen. You can brag about it properly. It's fine.
No, it's fantastic. Well done. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Thank you. I will send it to you.
Wonderful. And we're going to talk about Mia, but this is actually a good segue into just one thing I want to mention. Today, Flix.com, today you released their poll of the top 25.
Today is yesterday, by the way.
Today is yesterday. We may or may not be recorded. So yesterday, oops, well done, Glenn. Flix.com today, you released their poll of the top 25 Australian films of the 21st century as polled by critics in Australia, myself included. And they have released the list of... What is that look in your face, Farad? And yes, and...
That was a very not low-key brag, Glenn.
And, no, I was just commenting. Go look at my list. No, and the number one film...
You can click on flix.com.au.
Yes, the fire just scored out to Glenn Falconstein. And the number one film, which is actually my number one film, was Mad Max Fury Road. Though Sweet Country, which you referred to a moment ago, was number 8. Animal Kingdom was number 2. It's an interesting list.
I think Fury Road is great. And I think Sweet Country is great also. But I think it probably... It's too early to rank a movie in the top 25 Australian films of all time that came out, you know, like six months ago. I personally think there should be a little bit more time for it to settle before a movie starts to be included in these sorts of lists. But also, Sweet Country is fantastic, though, and I do expect it to see on lists in the future. I just take issue with that, with new releases being ranked that highly, personally.
But also, I feel it's indicative of how little people actually know about the history of Australian cinema that a film that releases about 6 months ago can make that sort of a list. I think people just need to go out and watch more Australian films.
Well, it's just the past 18 years, but there's a lot of good ones.
Still a lot.
Well, that's what I'm saying, the 21st century. It's the greatest films of the 21st century.
Oh, okay.
So it's like the earliest one is The Dish, which was 2000, and it goes all the way up to Sweet Country.
Okay, well...
What about Red Dog and all the Red Dog sequels?
No, but...
Red Dog, Here We Go Again.
God, Red Dog, Here We Go Again. No, we're not talking about... But the proposition was on there, which I did not vote for Red Dog, but I did vote for The Rover, which did not make the top 10, unfortunately. But
you must be roving mad.
Oh, it's such a good film. Our pats. But speaking... Actually, a moment ago was a decent segue into Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, which is the new film in cinemas. It is a 10... Is the 10-year sequel to Mamma Mia?
10-year late... 10th anniversary?
Yeah, 10th anniversary, I think.
This was the wonderful film which introduced the world to Amanda Seyfried in 2008, which was the jukebox musical of ABBA songs based on the stage play, which is the 8th longest running musical in the world.
Wait, this was the first movie of Amanda Seyfried?
It's where I first remember her.
Wow.
It was a breakout hit, I think that's fair.
Yeah, I don't think it was the first Amanda Seyfried film, though. I'm pretty sure I'd heard of her before this movie came out.
Well, this was, I think, her first really big...
Because the sequel made me think about why.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Was that her?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Okay, well, I take that.
Get out of the studio.
I take that back. Wow, Mean Girls. I have not seen Mean Girls. Okay, well, Glenn doing well tonight. This is the sequel to Mamma Mia. This is Mamma Mia 2. They have Godfather 2'd Mamma Mia. So we have gone 10 years into the future with all the characters, but then we've also gone back in time to relive the events that were alluded to in the first film with Lily James taking on the Meryl Streep Donna role, because Meryl Streep doesn't really do sequels. This was always going to divide audiences. My view, I grew up listening to ABBA.
I think so.
I had a lot of fun with this film, but I am an ABBA fanatic, and I'm someone who doesn't mind toe-tapping, humming like Pierce Brosnan, and singing along in the cinemas with everyone else. I remember the stage play. I thoroughly enjoyed it when it came to the lyric. And this was flawed in many respects, so we will get into some detail, I still thoroughly enjoyed this.
Yes, Mamma Mia 2, as I like to call it, Why We Here Again. I mean, honestly... the first time was great. In retrospect, the first time was actually fantastic when I look back at it. But
The first one was a movie that I, and I think a lot of other people, thought they were way too cool for when it was released. And on rewatching it, I can say it's actually really, really fun. I know that it's always bad faith to accuse people who say they really like something of not actually really liking something. But I wonder if the exuberant praise for this new film versus the original being panned is partly a result of people trying to atone for getting it wrong the first time around, saying, okay, I wasn't in tune with the sensibilities of what really connects with people, and trying to take it back by overpraising this one.
Yeah, I feel like there's been a slight trend in the enthusiasm for movie musicals over the last couple of years, especially we've had La La Land and we have The Greatest Showman. And, you know, it's not really about the quality anymore. And I think at the time when Mamma Mia was being shown, it was all about, you know, critiquing whether it was a good film or not. Whereas now, like, it is, you know, admittedly, I wasn't a big fan of the sequel, but I can see why people love it. You know, it's fun. It's just a good time. That's what people just want to, that's what people are looking for in the movie. And they're embracing it a lot more than I think they used to, like, they did before. Now they're like, you know, we know it's, I mean, quote unquote, trashy. We know that it's, you know, just here for me to have fun, you know?
Yeah, but I think just existing to give people a good time can be assessed on whether it succeeds or not. And I feel like the original succeeded in that, you know, goal, and this one didn't.
Yeah, you're right, because Chris and I were sufficiently lubricated before the screening, which I did appreciate. I mean, we had free-flowing alcohol, which is fantastic.
That's definitely a statement that requires some clarification.
Context
is important. Oh, I wish I could have made this. I was in Tel Aviv, but this sounds like you had an amazing time.
I mean, everyone, you know, did the best they could to prepare us for what's to come, which is, it's not a good movie, so we're going to make sure that you're the loosest possible so you can be in the best state to enjoy this and have a sing-along, which we did. In the theater, everyone was singing along to the songs, which made me feel like us watching the film were having more fun than the actors on the screen. And I think that was my biggest problem. The cast were trying too hard to have fun, and they were actually looking like they just didn't care. They turned up for a paycheck. That was my biggest issue with the film.
Yeah, I would say the same thing with different words and say that it actually felt like people weren't trying hard enough. You know, I didn't feel the sincere, outside of a few big show-stopping numbers like the Waterloo one, I didn't feel like a lot of people are sincerely trying really hard to put on a good show for you, which is the feeling you want to get when you watch a classic musical. I kind of felt like the actors were just kind of shrugging. The choreography was just kind of flat. The way it looks is pretty bland.
I mean, compared to the first, I mean, the first just like really indulged in the camera work and the choreography, and it was like, it was just there for it. But this one, I found the staging and the blocking and just where the cameras sat in a lot of the scenes just very static and very kind of far away from what was happening.
I agree with that. When Mamma Mia 1 came out, there was a lot of criticism of Phyllida Lloyd, who was the director of the stage production, making her film debut, about, oh, she doesn't know what to do with the camera, because people were assessing it in terms of whether it hits the marks that they expect in how a traditional musical would be shot. And it isn't, but looking at it now, there's a lot of creative and witty camera work in that movie, and a lot of really nice, goofy visual touches. The new one is, I think, maybe more conventionally successful in, you know, fully framing people going through, you know, classically choreographed dance sequences, but it's just so much more boring in comparison. I don't think there's any genuinely, you know, original shots in this like there were in the last one. And it's a whole lot less fun, I think, visually. It doesn't have crazy creative touches like disco lights suddenly popping out of nowhere and a magical dolphin animated fountain in the courtyard.
That was
the original
great the
was genuinely wacky, and that adds so much more to the sense of fun.
And I'd actually go a little further in terms of the visual elements and say that in terms of the set design, it felt like a musical stage. And I don't mind stage productions, and I enjoy stage, and I grew up watching theatre. But in terms of the sets, in the first one, it actually looked like we were on a Greek island. It did not look like this time.
That's exactly right. No, I'm sure there were sets used in the first one for a lot of the places where we're seeing the sets here, like the courtyard. But the original mixed it in with incredible location photography of the islands and the sea, which adds so much more to the sense of over-the-top campy drama that some of the ABBA songs evoke. And the issue with how fake this one looks is it doesn't look fake in an attractive way. They're not pushing up the fakiness. It just looks like a cheap TV set.
Okay, it seems like I'm going to be the one to defend this film. I disagree that there are actually some incredibly exuberant sequences. I'm going to point out a couple. Waterloo, which is incredibly inventively staged and Dante was well done. Super Trooper was later well done. And on this, I agree that there's a lack of exuberance in some of the returning cast members, but I think this is due more to not them some of them being tired, but not given enough scope. Certainly the Harry character, Colin Firth, deserved a lot more. He was incredibly shortchanged to the point that they actually introduced some inconsistencies in the story. They belonged there much more. But the saving grace of this film, and it really is the saving grace, is we have to give credit to Lily James. Lily James is a better singer than Meryl Streep. She is absolutely superb. We played earlier Mamma Mia, and that rendition, it starts with just vocals and then it moves up and up and up and is absolutely marvelous. Her version of Andante actually rivals many of the recordings of ABBA. And I've got to say, ABBA is good because it is meant to be played live. The recordings of ABBA performing the songs live are better than most of the studio versions because they have these unique tempos. And the film captures that in so many respects. And in so many scenes, knowing you was terrible, Fernando was terrible, but most of them, I feel, particularly Mamma Mia and Andante, made it superb and do recommend the film on its own.
Okay, Lily James was fantastic. I do agree with that. But can we talk about her character in the film? Because the sexual politics of this movie is very confused. And you're going to annoy me by saying, why are you talking about sexual politics in a musical, Virat? What the hell are you doing? But this movie had, like, honestly, look at Lily James's character. He was playing a younger version of Meryl Streep's character. She goes around the entire film, trying to tell people that I'm not that kind of girl, except she's this free-spirited radical hippie who does follow her dream. I brought this up in my original review in The Breakfast, but the thing is, the idea that the writers are confused, which one of them includes Richard Curtis, as to what kind of audience this movie is going for.
I think they don't want to alienate conservative people so that the character has to keep saying, I don't usually do this, I'm not this kind of girl, but like, who cares if she does, right?
Exactly. Because,
if you're going to make a movie about a person who doesn't know who the father is, then I feel like they should just embrace the free-willing sexual, freedom, the summer of love thing that this movie seems to be going for in other ways, but it's contradicting itself. I don't know.
On one hand, it's all about radical progressiveness and free-spiritedness and doing what the heart wants. But on the other hand, she graduates from New College, Oxford. So, what kind of world-colliding mess is this, you know? And also, this idea, this film is so ashamed of embracing the free-spiritedness of Lily James's character. If she is truly going after her heart and doing what she wants to do,
we're giving this movie way too much of a close reading because it basically has no story. I think one of the huge things that stops this movie from working or having as much charm as the original is that between the constant flashbacks and flash forwards and the endless songs, there's no time for any kind of plot line to emerge. And the plot that we're going through in the flashbacks is something that was completely covered in the original. So as Virat says,
it was very predictable. They
discussed it. They described all these events, and through actually seeing them depicted instead of just hearing them told to you, you don't actually gain any new perspective. The characters never are developed in the flashback sequences, and you don't feel like you get to see enough of the characters you like in the flash forward scenes. A storyline just never coheres. So it's basically purely there as a jukebox.
Yeah.
There's no characters and no arcs and no themes. It's just using the flimsiest of premises to launch from song to song to song. Whereas the original, I think, actually had some charm.
It had charm, characters. It had substance.
And the story.
Yeah, and I think with this, it doesn't actually understand the way that the songs are used as well. So in the first one, it'd be like something would happen. You'd have some character development and then a song would emerge that would inform
that
narrative.
They express themselves through song.
Exactly. And I think that's what we need more from, what we needed more from this sequel. So for example, the first song, When I Kissed the Teacher, Lily James, who plays the young Meryl Streep, she graduates and she just goes and she just bursts out in her graduation speech, her valedictorian speech, I kissed the teacher for no reason at all. Like, it never informed the narrative in any sort of way. It didn't feel like it led on very well. I think what Knowing Me, Knowing You, after Lily James has a relationship with, what's his, Jeremy Irvine?
We're going to come back to this in just one moment. I just want to say we're going to continue on the podcast. So Debbie Zhao, you'll be joining us on the podcast, but just thank you for joining us on air. We'll be back next week talking all things Mission Impossible, and we'll be continuing on the podcast talking James Gunn at Equalizer 2. Debbie, thank you so much for joining us and continuing to chat to us all things Mamma Mia.
Thank you so much.
1, 2, 3, and welcome to the Film Fight Club podcast. Why are we counting in and counting out now?
Maybe this will be the new thing we do.
Very smooth, Glenn.
It just started. You heard genesis of this new tradition.
Yeah, yeah. You
heard we're teaching us counting as well as talking about films.
Yes.
We've been 18.
can we go further than three? I don't know. Yes.
Mean, double digits is too hard for me.
Is there really anything left to say about Mamma Mia 2?
I mean,
It's got no story.
Yeah, it's got no story. The music doesn't flow.
Honestly,
Colin Firth, because I wanted to talk about that when he has little screen time. He's actually the funniest and actually seems like the goofiest character.
The spontaneous person.
He was funny.
He's the goofiest character because he seems like the only one who's embracing the spirit of the film and the universe. Mm. And everyone else, especially Pierce Brosnan, he's doing his schlick, oh my God, I'm Pierce Brosnan kind of thing.
You're talking to Pierce Brosnan right here.
No, but like, I just wanted to punch him in the face.
Wow.
Ooh.
Okay, all right, I'm going to defend...
Not like physically, but like,
so much violence from Variety in this episode. Yeah, wow. From murdering people crazy who bought Taiwanese film festival tickets.
Yeah, please go buy those
punching
tickets.
Pierce Brosnan,
you're not
going to
be murdered by Variety. So I'm going to...
I can't defend myself today.
Well, I will defend this film on 3 points that have been raised. Number one, Pierce Brosnan. Pierce Brosnan singing SOS in the original has been so lampooned. But you know what? He is all of us. He is me sitting in the Mamma Mia Theatre singing along. And I am so glad he got to revisit it in this. I think it was quite elegant, I've got to say.
If I may say so, Glenn, you have a better voice than Pierce Brosnan singing.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Wow.
My loyalties are not with my compatriots at Film Fight Club.
I was about to be like, that's so sweet. And I just hear, oh, no. No, but Chris, yeah,
no,
wow.
Like,
no, but
we've sung songs together and I can stomach that.
We're all pretty bad. And Pierce Brosnan is also bad, but not that bad.
No, Pierce Brosnan
right?
sounds like, you know...
Okay, he's bad by the standards of people who sing in Hollywood musicals. He's not bad like bad karaoke.
Okay, he's not like Russell Crowe in Les Miserables.
Yeah, Russell Crowe was way worse.
Yeah, that was just like, I don't know, a squeaking toad got mixed with a haunting gorilla or something, you know? So that was just, I don't know.
Tell me what and why and where. Let him answer all these questions. Let him answer to Javert. It was so bad.
Wow.
You mean
that was
Javiet.
It was Javert.
I'm going by Twitter.
I saw it on the West, where I also saw Mamma Mia. And this is the thing. Another point I will defend the film on, the song transitions, they were awkward, but they were supposed to be awkward. They were self-conscious. In the theater, I remember we went in to Take a Chance on Me and Chiquita, and they're supposed to be like that. And I don't mind that they don't entirely... Some of the songs are Gimme, 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 in the original, also Money, Money, Money in the original, I think didn't quite fit. I think some of them, One of Us, fit very well.
I did like Angel Eyes in this one, and the Christine Baranski chemistry and the very sarcastic, sardonic sort of, you know.
She was funny.
How good is she? She had the best lines in this movie.
She was hilarious in the first one as well. Look, the performers make such a difference in this. I agree that Colin Firth was really good and there wasn't enough of him. And I also agree that Lily James was fantastic. She seems like a real movie star here, right? Like Lily James sung so well. She had so much charisma and warmth. And she's really, really attractive, which really has no bearing on the... it's not a great critical
film
comment, but
again.
It's the truth, right? According to me.
She makes the film very fun.
She's really good. No.
Let's hear for the PG rating.
Yes. It's true. She's no. I'll back her. She is stunning. She's stunning. She absolutely
she
is.
Absolutely is.
Yeah. She's we'll ever say. Yeah.
She is a great performer. It's not.
It's true. She's stunning.
Everyone's looking at me like I've said the dirtiest thing ever when I said that she's attractive after listing all the things about how she's a really good performer with a lot of charisma. She owns the camera in this.
F for fun, you know?
And you know what? The best part...
For fun's sake.
Yes. Well, the best part of this film, and I can see why, and I actually heard a lot of my friends who said this about the film after, they really loved like the mother-daughter relationship and the parallels between Meryl Streep, like Donna, and... her daughter, so Amanda, as she's like at the very end when she's coming through to the church and I don't want to spoil the film, but there are parallels.
Okay, spoiler of the film, Meryl Streep's in the movie. But this isn't really a spoiler because her name's listed on the she's first of all, she's physically on the poster and she's listed in the cast list.
Yes, okay. On that point, I felt so bloody cheated about Meryl Streep being in the movie for how long she's in the movie. She could barely be not in this movie and wouldn't have made any darn difference. Oh my God, that is such a blatant sucker punch to my balls. Not even in a good way.
Wow, okay. And
what is happening today?
And speaking of, I'm going to transition out of this. So speaking about very short cameos and bad cameos in this instance, Cher. What was she doing here? She was not good in this.
Yikes.
I mean, I appreciate that there's an audience for Cher. There was a lady at the back of my center who was saying, is that Cher? Is that Cher? I'm not a Cher fan, so it didn't do it for me, but I appreciate that a core part of the audience for this film.
Rewatching the first one has reminded me that Meryl Streep's mom, first of all, was said that Meryl Streep's Donna is basically was dead to her mom the moment that she was pregnant and never saw her again. And furthermore, after that, she also says that her mom is dead.
Yes.
Don't tell me that her mom is Cher, some like cool progressive pop star woman. No, she said she was dead to her, but she was some conservative in Alabama, right?
Yeah, no.
Like that's...
My favorite corny line from this movie was when Amanda Seyfried's character has his realization that, oh my God, my mother could go through all the troubles and everything because she had me.
Oh, that was the dumbest line
and
ever.
And I was listening.
No, what it was,
it was sweet.
No, but it was
I actually thought it was quite sweet as well.
Thank you. I like it, Debbie. Yeah.
I was thinking biologically, and I'm like,
a little bit.
Look, childbearing, and like you're a hippie with no kind of barter system or like any kind
says,
of economic.
My mom had
ideas.
No one.
Oh, the politics.
She says she says my mom had no one. You know, I have all these friends. I've got my three dads and my partner and all my friends and such to help me through this. But my mom had no one to help her. You know, through pregnancy. It's like, no, but she had you. And that, then Amanda Seyfried goes, well, I'm even more lucky then because I've got all these people and my unborn child to help me. But like,
I thought that was lovely.
I don't know.
That was lovely too. I thought the parallels between the daughter and the mother were so lovely.
Look,
like,
I actually liked the parallel in its culmination at the end. That actually got to me. That was actually lovely.
And why did it? Why was it so emotionally powerful? Because there was build up.
Yeah, but not in that really dumb line that I laughed at when they said it.
and
the other reason I would say is because Meryl Streep is in it, who is again has
just automatically lights up a room.
Yeah, automatically
and can sing better. She has learned to sing a lot better following. What was the film
Into
she
the
made?
Woods.
Into the Woods.
Into the Woods.
There was it was so good. Into the Woods. There was another musical she made of Florence Foster Jenkins.
Nice. Oh yeah.
Yeah. So but
her character. Couldn't sing in that movie.
Yeah, anyway. She learned to sing as part of that role. They did do training for it. Yeah, but not a lot. Obviously, Into the Woods is
the other starring role, the other kind of starring member of this cast in Mamma Mia 2 was the horse. Let's talk about the horse because it made a very important story.
Nothing in the story is important in this movie.
The entire story is negligible. They try to explain
the
a plot point badly at the end.
She gets the hotel is because she saved a horse at home, and just like which belonged to this, you know, restaurant owner who didn't say you get to have the hotel because you saved my horse. And I'm like, quit horsing around. Just hoof
it
away.
It was. I didn't mind that. It was the whole story was negligible. They're trying to explain massive inconsistencies in bad throwaways towards the end of the film when they do a post-credit sequence. But a couple of points I will defend this on. In terms of the mother being dead, yes, I did rewatch the original recently. Yes, that is in there.
Not only dead, but also definitely not as described the character that she's revealed to be in this movie.
On that, okay. In Frasier, Cheers. In the episode of Cheers, Frasier says that Martin is dead, and then that we've not had 11 years of wonderful Frasier, 6 years of wonderful Frasier, the other 5 seasons were terrible, if they had allowed this fiction to just go on. It was fine. It was good for the purposes of the story. I didn't mind it. And also, just on some of the songs, was it Chris?
Yeah. What?
I thought you were going to say something.
No, I was just listening.
Okay, look, this is, I would say about this film, this, and Christine Baranski, just who is amazing, this is a film for people who not only love the original,
Christine Baranski
but
is,
who
is
have
great.
Absolutely no shame in getting up in the theater and absolutely belting it out. And I think even if you don't necessarily are a big ABBA fan, you can come to this film and you can learn some ABBA songs. I learned a couple too and thoroughly enjoy it.
One last quick nitpicky thing. The best throwaway line for me was this political commentary that popped up randomly in this movie when this group of farmers...
Oh, yeah, they felt weird about setting a movie for about rich Anglo people having the time of their lives in Greece now that since this movie came out, it's had its economic crash since the original.
Just trying to be, oh my God, we need to be with the times. We're 10 years later and Greece is not rich anymore. People just don't come here to have their time of their lives because nobody can survive.
Look, this is a film. Okay. This is a
random
film.
Drop of, as if this movie was ever set in the real Greece.
All right, look. You know, this is a film.
It's set in fantasy land.
Speaking of cultural issues, where they, about a Swedish band where they referred to Stockholm, Sweden, as if we didn't know where Stockholm was. But more importantly, there's a scene in Paris where a bunch of British people are singing about Waterloo. So, you know, culturally, this film isn't going for the super, super sensitive points. But on the political issue that Virat raised earlier, this entire film, and it's consistent with the Pierce Brosnan younger character, is about people who may be in certain good, or at least appear to be in good places in life, and be thrown into a deep end. And I feel as much as they did set in Oxford to really, really push the point, and they may have been a little on the nose in that respect, I think it was fine because that was the thing they're going for, and they delivered that well, at least the flashback scenes.
It's only as absurd as Meryl Streep on a cruise liner singing Money, Money, Money in the original. So
I missed that. Yeah, I missed that.
This is similarly on the nose to that, I would say.
In terms of good performance, to compliment Lily James, going back to Waterloo, the younger version of Colin Firth's character is played by Hugh Skinner. He is fantastic in this movie.
Waterloo, couldn't escape if I wanted to. So good.
He was so goofy and funny. And like for the limited role he got, I really enjoyed him. I wish I could, you know, explore more his filmography.
Ol Parker, who wrote and directed this, is lucky to have cast Lily James, you know, because without a performer of such magnetism, I almost said of such magnitude, without a performer of such magnetism, a lot of the flashback scenes would have totally fallen apart. I agree that the young Colin Firth guy is good, but the rest of them were just totally boring, especially in comparison to how great, you know, Stellan Skarsgård and Pierce Brosnan, you know, yes,
good old Pierce. Thank you, Chris. Thank you.
Now, Chris, I love the hints you're dropping. First, you call Lily James attractive, and now you call her magnetism. So, you know, I see what you're doing there. Attractive, magnetism.
No, she's gorgeous, but at this point, I'm just talking about her charisma. Okay,
I'm appreciating the synonyms of magnetism and attractiveness,
I didn't take that from that at all.
Okay. Kind of incorporating. Anyway,
all right. So that was
we're polar opposites on that one.
So that was Mamma Mia 2, starring the very attractive Lily James, which is in cinemas now. And we will be talking in a moment about James Gunn and also The Equalizer 2. But first, just a couple of things that are happening around town. We interviewed last year the director of the Smartphone Flick Fest. There's two directors, Ali Kroon and Angela Blake. They had their entries for the Short Film Festival closing in 16 days. I've been each year now. It's going into the fourth year. It's a really fun festival. And they've moved now from the Chevelle to the Opera House. So it's a really fantastic venue. And they've done really, really well as a festival. So please do get your entries in. The other thing is Just Between Us, a film. Not Just Between Us.
What is it?
Oh, God, no.
Just for you guys.
Just for all of us. Just Between Us. It's a film called Just Between Us. It's an Aussie road flick, which has its Sydney premiere tomorrow night at Dendy Newtown. And then it's going out of all things, a road trip around the place. It's about a couple of young filmmakers. So something to check out if you're just because it's going to be in and out of cinemas. But that's Just Between Us. Just Between Us. Glenn. The next thing. I just got the thumbs up from Debbie there.
You're doing very well.
Yeah. The next thing we're talking about is, do we want to talk James Gunn?
Yeah.
I think we want to talk James Gunn. We're changing tone just a little bit here. We can each talk a little bit about what's going on here. So essentially, a couple of days, James Gunn is the director of Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2. Was?
No, is. It is. Will always be the director of Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2. And Romeo and Juliet.
Oh no, he did that, didn't he?
And Super.
Super was so good.
Yeah, and he wrote the script for Slither. I don't think he directed it.
No, I don't think so either. But he has been taken off. The Guardians of the Galaxy 3 has been fired by Disney because a number of tweets he made a number of years ago, which he has since apologized for following this controversy, has resurfaced. The tweets are some pretty out there jokes about some pretty serious issues, including pedophilia.
Yeah, we can't say them on the radio, but basically there were lots of punchlines about raping kids.
Yep. So there's a number of views on this issue.
Content warning about sexual assault.
A number of views on this issue that have come up in the past few days. One is that they were right to fire him. another, a number of people expressed to me is that Disney knew and should have done fired him ages ago before they made money off them. Others have said that Disney have overreacted and or have should have accepted his apology. I take a slightly different view on this personally. My personal view is that Disney is an organization that is founded by, of all people, Walt Disney, who, if you look it up, has an incredibly awful and sordid history himself. I've watched Disney films my whole life. I will continue to watch Disney films and enjoy Disney series, whatever they may be. I think Disney as an organization has asked audiences over decades to accept that they, as a company, have moved on or have changed. I certainly have accepted this, as have many others, and I do not believe this is a courtesy that they extended to James Gunn. We're going to talk about this more generally, but there's one other point I really quickly want to make. What has been also reported as part of this is that a particular individual, group of individuals were involved in these tweets surfacing. I think many outlets have reported very well, but not giving these individuals undue publicity.
I reckon in this context, we can name and shame him. This guy is responsible for perpetuating the Pizzagate conspiracy theory. The moral crusader stance that he's taking is utterly absurd. Pizzagate, for people who aren't aware, is about... you're looking at me like...
Oh, God, no, I'm just lying. Pizzagate is a controversy about apparently a pizzeria very close to where I used to live in D.C., which were running, the Hillary Clinton campaign or something? Something absurd. They were running...
Then they were saying that that people involved... The pizza shop was used as a child sex trafficking ring by Democrat. Sorry, I'm laughing because it's so absurd. By Democratic Party officials. It was a blatant fiction
It's not any more absurd than saying the people who were caught up in the shootings are child actors. So, I mean...
Yeah, it's a ridiculous conspiracy
theory. Any far-right conspiracy is ridiculous at this point.
Which has led to the response that the attempts to discredit James Gunn are more about silencing a very prominent anti-Trump voice on Twitter than they are about Cernovich taking a genuine moral stand. And some people have raised the issue that the right is now weaponizing the left's outrage culture. I think it's a bit more nuanced because I think just because the issue has been brought up by Mike Cernovich doesn't mean that James Gunn's comments are okay. I guess I'd like to hear what the rest of the panel has to say about it.
Yeah, I agree with Chris, which doesn't happen that often, but I'm glad that I
it's
do.
It's happening whenever increasingly we do, often.
Well, I'm trying to maintain a contrarian stance, Chris. Thank you. The thing is, what Chris pointed out, and I do agree with that, and that's a very salient point. The idea of nuance is getting lost in the Twitter kind of 2040 characters kind of culture, which used to be 140 characters at one point. But I think everything has to be digestibly broken down into a soundbite. And Chris was right in mentioning this idea that I'm very uncomfortable to the fact that, yes, James Gunn was wrong in whatever he tweeted back then, and he's taken responsibility for that, but that doesn't absolve him from his actions back then. But at the same time, that doesn't make this kind of outrage culture, especially this kind of vindictive culture that sprung up on Twitter around people trying to settle personal vendettas by, you know, going through people's personal histories and using that against other people to then out them as kind of, you know, bad people. So I think people are using social media as weapons to settle their personal scores and personal agendas, and that's very troubling. And both can be right at the same time. James Gunn was not right to say what he said at the time, but that doesn't mean that how he was outed was also something which is beyond, you know, critique.
I didn't actually know about the context around why he was outed. That actually gives a little bit more.
Yeah, he is one probably the most anti-Trump celebrity. Every single day he's just hammering Twitter with jokes about Trump and stuff to oppose, you know, messages against him.
Certainly his last tweet before this controversy broke was very much along those lines.
Yeah.
Many others.
Yeah.
I see. Well, I guess that gives a little bit more context about it. I mean, I guess it's conflicting because about the discussion point that Glenn, you raised about Disney, why didn't they fire him earlier if they knew about it?
And that's the thing. Right. I reckon Disney definitely knew. Look, the guy used to work for Troma, who are known for boundary pushing, poor taste humor. That's their entire identity. So Disney definitely knew that this kind of thing is associated with James Gunn. I personally, like, I think the jokes are bad, right? I think the issue is this is now in the media, and Disney doesn't want to be associated with the idea of pedophilia ever.
And they also had a similar reaction to when Roseanne tweeted, which is a very different situation because that was contemporaneous.
I think that's different for a number of reasons. One is that, yes, that's contemporaneous. Two is that Roseanne, I think, failed to adequately apologize or own up to it, whereas I think James Gunn apologized for this sort of thing years ago, and by the accounts of all the people who know him, actually has changed, doesn't make humor along these lines today. Some people have taken issue with the idea that we should believe in people's apologies or their requests for forgiveness, and people have brought up the idea of, okay, this is like a 40-year-old man, we're not talking about a teenager. Should we actually believe that he's changed?
Yeah, I guess I was about to bring up that conflict because, yeah, on one side it's, you know, it's a resurface of tweets, which happened quite a while ago. But, you know, he was 40 years old. He was obviously mature. He obviously knows what he's doing. But, you know, then there's the other side of the argument where it's saying, should we give people the opportunity to change, you know? Yes.
The other thing that kind of I'm thinking about is what is the current climate that we are a part of? Because these tweets have been around, like you said, these tweets have resurfaced, and that's a very important point. So the idea that these tweets are now more loaded in the current climate than they were before.
I think that's absolutely true.
The fact that they've always existed, people haven't had a problem back then when they were originally posted as much as people have an issue today about these things.
And
so
this
it's
is
the current political climate.
Disney should have stood by their employee because... As I've said before, they definitely knew this. They knew about this stuff. I think the bigger issue here is that for Disney is that they have a massive merger going ahead with Fox at the end of the week. So they're trying to they tried to scrub away any bad publicity that could possibly come up. And I think they jumped the gun.
But also they're merging with Fox, of all people. And Fox is notorious for its umbrella of whatever controversial.
Fox shareholders are voting on it, and and the value of Disney is their family-friendly image, and I think that's what Disney's trying to maintain. In terms of the issues we were talking about before, about whether people can change or be forgiven, if we're talking about something like Kevin Spacey, I think something like that is just not forgivable, and I don't think that you can buy into people's, you know, statement that they've changed, especially if they only apologize if they are caught out. In the case of what James Gunn did, I think it's important to remember that regardless of what people like Mike Cernovich would try to imply, James Gunn is not actually a pedophile. These were jokes. And I understand the nuance that jokes can normalize negative behaviors or have play a role in, I guess, trivializing the issue for people on top of the pain that they can cause to victims of abuse. But it's fairly easy for me to, like, of all the things you're asking me to believe that a person's changed with regard to, making jokes would be one of the easiest. You know, like, it's easy for me to believe that somebody goes through a shift in understanding where they realize that certain types of humor that they went into in the past because they viewed the top priority as being shocking people maybe aren't such a good idea, especially when you move from the context of being somebody who works for trauma to being someone who's a extremely active left-wing, you know, activist. Furthermore, James Gunn has actually addressed this stuff in the past. There's an interview from 2014 where he expresses regret about the person that he was on Twitter and says that he... And this is not when being prompted for an apology. This was just in the context when talking about how he's changed as a person. He said, I was always a really nasty guy on Twitter trying to be edgy, and he was worried that's such a big part of my identity. I'm not going to be able to do that anymore when Disney... hired him to work on Guardians of the Galaxy, but then he later on came to realize that it was a good thing not to do that, and that all he was ever really doing was doing something he'd done through his whole life, which was pushing people away.
But it does blur the line, like, as well, because it's like, yes, they jokes, you know, but does that also tell us who you were at that point, or who you are at this point, you know?
But
like, it's not just a tweet. It's also reflective of his values, right?
I agree with that. The point I've been trying to make through all of this isn't these jokes and who cares. Like, I genuinely think the jokes are bad, and I think they are something worthy of apologizing for. But I question the value of going after somebody who claims that they changed years ago, who owned this and brought it up without being prompted to and spoke about regretting it, and now apologizes again, not just because he's been caught, but in keeping with his apologies over the years, and now he catches the fall for it. It's like, do we believe that, like, what do we need to take to believe that people actually can change? What does it need to believe, you know, that somebody can be forgiven? At what point is it, you know, when did it stop being so bad to give people the benefit of the doubt on this? Because James Gunn's response to me doesn't just seem like a PR-crafted whatever apology like Roseanne gave.
And just to note, there are any number of actors who, and performers, people in Hollywood who have said or done outrageous things, who have since either been forgiven or not called up on it, and still make studios, a like James Gunn, a ridiculous amount of money.
One other thing that Chris brought up, and I've been thinking about it, and I have incredible sort of issue with it, is actually more concerning. And this is the idea of how the politicized environment, especially in social media, how the right has co-opted the weapons of the left and used it against itself, especially identity politics, and especially this kind of umbrella embracing and the idea of free speech, and how using that against the left, its own kind of ideology, has become, you know, quite, I think, toxic in that sense. Like, you know, especially this rhetoric around fascism and anti-fascists, it's all, I think, in a way, I admire the doggedness of the right in somehow twisting ideologies off. I admire in the sense that how you have to be incredibly ruthless and in a way efficient to do that, by simplifying nuance to that extent that it becomes absurdity ad nauseum, right? That it actually loses the essence of the main thing and it becomes something that can be weaponized against itself. It's scary. It's truly scary.
To go further with the hypocrisy of Disney in terms of, and Hollywood in general, Disney had brought to their attention the ongoing, pretty much for the entirety of his career, sexual abuse perpetuated and harassment perpetuated by John Lasseter during his time at Pixar. And the response to those allegations was a long period of internal review. And even though they acknowledged that, yes, they were true, they still have agreed to keep paying him until the end of this year. And so he isn't officially terminated until then. Whereas James Gunn, who's not, as far as we know, and I think we would know by now, responsible for any actual harassment during his time working at Disney or in his time in Hollywood, was let go immediately based on stuff that he apologized for years ago. I think it shows a massive misplacement of, you know, a moral center. I don't know. It smacks of hypocrisy to me.
So that is the recent James Gunn controversy. I'm sure we have not heard the end of it, or similar events that may or may occur in the future in Hollywood and the corporate world and else. Next up, we're going to be talking about The Equalizer 2 soon, but first we want to talk about something that's very exciting that's happening. We're going down to Melbourne for the Melbourne International Film Festival, and each year they hold the Critics Campus, which Debbie is a member or a participant of the CFL Critics Term, and you're one of the critics in-house, and you're going to tell us all about it because we're excited to see it and see what you're going to do and come up with.
First of all, congratulations.
Yes.
Thanks.
Well done. It's
yay,
good.
Yay, famous people in the studio.
Cool. Not at all. Yeah, no, I'm really excited. It's a one-week intensive thing, and we are paired with a mentor. So my mentor is pretty sure I can reveal it, is Jessica Tian from The Playlist and Variety. Oh, fantastic. So, yeah, so she's
wonderful.
Yeah, she's been a favorite critic of mine for a couple of years, so it'd be very exciting to finally meet her and to get some advice from her. But the other critics, so there's seven others, and some other fantastic mentors who are around the country, and one's from New York as well. And it will be, you know, we'll be producing, you know, some features, interviews, reviews, hopefully across the week. And yeah, I guess I'm not so sure exactly what's in store, but I will be able to report back.
Yeah, I think Luke is organizing it.
Yes,
this year,
Luke
isn't he?
Is.
Yeah, Luke
Goodsell,
he's fantastic. And Conan Bateman, good old mate, Content Bateman, is mentor this year for the Critics Campus. Excited to pick his brains from his mentoring skills, and hopefully he can be nice and curly hair and his incredible beard. Anyway, that's
wow. Shout out to my neighbor Connor, hey. And yeah, so we're all looking forward to Critics Campus, so that is absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
So next up, we are discussing The Equalizer 2. I caught the original on TV with my roommate a little while ago. I was a little underwhelmed. I haven't seen Equalizer 2 yet, but Virat and Chris have both seen the starring Denzel Washington. What did we think?
It's trying to be so many movies at once, and I think I had issues with that. It's trying to be this kind of, you know, Logan, essentially, and I think that's been a template.
Every movie is trying to be Logan.
Yeah, you know, this template of trying to mentor this young kid with the father figure kind of thing. And it's trying to be this kind of, you know, assassin John Wick style movie as well, which is with his watch and trying to time his kills, which is pretty cool. Denzel being 60 is also trying to be a Taken kind of movie. It's trying to be so many movies at once, except and it doesn't do any movie justice in its patterns.
I thought this was actually much better than the original, though still not that good, because the original I was fairly disgusted by, because I think it was indulging in wish fulfillment violence, the fantasy that like you could be this powerful person who just gets to kill people whenever they piss him off. And in this, the second movie, by comparison, is not just a parade of nasty semi-pornographic violence. The second film is much slower paced, probably has less than half as much action as the original. It actually has characters in it. I appreciated the long build-up of the revenge narrative before we finally get to see Denzel doing his indestructible killing machine bit at the end. I thought there were some nice flourishes in terms of the direction in this movie. Anton Fuqua has some style. I can't say that I genuinely cared about any of the characters, but I appreciated some of the set pieces. There's a bit involving a two-way mirror in this that is really suspenseful and an original idea for this kind of film.
That was really clever. And also I like how the movie is trying to make some points about black identity and you know, racial politics, especially with the books it talks about. It talks about Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates, which is a very sort of, you know, I think our seminal narrative of the 21st century in terms of racial identity and U.S. politics and that kind of book. So I was glad how it brought in literature to talk about black identity. And I think in that sense, it was really interesting rather than giving Denzel-level speeches, which he often gets to give in these kind of movies. So it was restrained Denzel, which I did appreciate.
In the first movie, Denzel was basically, as I alluded to before, invulnerable. And just to further the fantasy of like, yeah, just like kill those guys. In this movie, as I said before, it's much more of a plot with stakes. So the fact that when it does come down to Denzel in a violent situation, he is just such a force of nature, does, I think, detract from the possible tension that could have been there. In order to mine the most tension, they need to take Denzel out of the scenario. You know, they create tension out of Denzel's on the phone and he can't save these people. And that does detract from this as an engaging revenge story. The best action heroes, I think, you identify with them because you see their struggle, and it's about how are they going to get past that when they have all these flaws and limitations, as well as being really, really talented in one area. Denzel can just take out as many people as there are, no matter how talented they are. He's basically a superhero, you know? It's the Punisher.
Yeah. And that's okay. And I did appreciate this movie was, in some sense, with a subplot, going to try to build up a more interesting, nuanced political narrative about, you know, black communities trying to escape their cyclical violence enforced by their own people on them. And how do you
escape
that?
Who better
to
take them out than Denzel, the killing machine?
Exactly. So, you know, how do you deal with that and try to give a nuanced response to it, except It didn't do that in the end.
No, so it didn't.
You know, but there were seeds were sown, and I was like, oh my god, talking about trying to see codes
honestly,
between the world and me. So like, there was bits that I was like, oh my god,
in terms of its focus on characters and the slowness of its pace, it's way more like an adult film than most of the action movies we get these days, and more mature than the original.
It's not your bro kind of Fast and Furious, and you know, summer action popcorn flick. In that way, it's more. It's slightly better.
It's all right. You know, it's like it's such a, you're going to watch this at 11:30 p.m. one night.
That's what I watched the original. That's exactly what I watched the original.
Oh
my god.
It's exactly that. See it on TV and like it'll do the job.
So we have two. So there was the second of two extremely unnuanced films this week. I recommend Mommy of the Two, which I didn't.
I prefer Equalizer 2, but it's not that much better, you know.
I would recommend you wait a week to watch Mission Impossible and just skip anything.
Well, we haven't seen Crazy Rich Asians.
Yes.
Wait another month for Crazy Rich Asians. It'll be worth it.
Yes, there's a clashing preview screenings tomorrow night. I made the decision. The first Mission Impossible was the first action film I ever saw.
Crazy Rich Asians just the week after.
Oh, it's the week. Oh. Wait. Oh, I can see both. Yes. Yes. I was in Malibu last night and the trailer for this came on.
Yes.
Oh, wow. This looks hilarious. They go to Singapore. And wait, what is Crazy Rich Asians about? I wonder. It seems pretty straightforward.
Varad might have some words.
That was all off air, Chris. That was all off air.
This is a callback to an in-joke about Varad's accidental racism.
It's not accidental. It's quite clearly misinformed, but the point is
it was actually none of that. Varad misspoke himself earlier and gave him no amount of shit for it. No limit.
What I'm trying to say is
of trashing Varad.
I feel Indian people should be called Asians too. We've been trying to be part of the Asian clan for a long time, so please, Indian people are Asian too. We are South Asians, which is like a kind of Asian. So
there was a great joke about this in Blockers, actually. Remember? Yeah. With John Cena. Anyway, so I'm gonna have dinner now with the Race Discrimination Commissioner and see what he thinks about that. This is actually true. I am having dinner with the Race Discrimination Commissioner, so on that note, that's the exact way. Yes, glad. I hope he's not listening to this. Oh no. Hey Tim, so yes, this has been
what a disastrously politically charged episode this has been.
I know. Wow. Wow, this has
managed to offend everybody.
Everybody,
in the political film fight club.
Everybody, there's a few ethnic groups we haven't covered yet. We'll, that's next week.
Yeah,
that's next week, surely. So
I just hope none of us get a job at Disney in 10 years.
Yes,
yes.
Beware white people.
True that. All right, so Debbie, thank you so much for coming on. It's been an interesting episode. And we'll surely have you on again come Myth in a couple of weeks.
Yes, yeah. Keen.
It's going to be fun.
We'll see you there. And I'll see you at the, it's not the hub, whatever the Myth equivalent is.
The Melman version.
The forum. Forum. It's pretty nice. It's nice.
Yeah, cool. They're hub.
Yeah, they're hub.
Yes. So see what all the hubbub is about.
Yeah, the hubbub.
Fantastic.
So this has been Glenn Falkenstein, Debbie Zhao, Chris Evans of Rotten Root. That's just for Disney, so future reference. And
put these people on the blacklist. don't even bother.
And we will see you next week talking about Mission Impossible and a later date, Crazy Rich Asians. Oh my god, I'm excited for this.
Yes.
It's gonna be good. Have a wonderful night. Enjoy movies. Good night.
Be politically radical.